Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
That's much better. You know, the wonderful thing about conferences like this is that you get asked questions even before breakfast. And the first question today was, why on earth would you want to look at an ancient book like the Book of Daniel in the 21st century? And I'm aiming to answer that question. The first immediate answer is the question of leadership. Daniel turned out to be one of the most competent leaders, not simply in the Bible, but in all of secular history. And this is the very famous painting of him by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. He rose to lead an empire, the Babylonian Empire, first of all, which stretched from the Mediterranean to Persia. And when that empire collapsed and was replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire, the incoming emperor Darius had the sense to see he had a genius in Daniel, and so Daniel ruled over the Medo-Persian Empire as well. The capital of each of these empires was Babylon. So it was not a change of capital, it was a change of regime. There are very few people who have experienced leadership at this level in the first place, and secondly, who have reigned over two empires. The nearest I can think of it is the transition of Hong Kong from British rule to Chinese rule. And it's very interesting when you study what happened then. There were some Christians involved in that, believers, who expedited that transition and made what could have been very difficult a lot easier. The book itself is interested in empire. It's a large-scale book. And there is a third empire mentioned in the book itself, and that is the Macedonian Empire, which was even bigger than the previous two. And finally, of the biblical empires implied, I believe, in Daniel, there is the Roman Empire. So, first of all, we have someone who rose to a leadership position. Now, medics tend to end up in leadership positions. They have often the power of life and death, and people look up to them for direction. So at that level, anything I'm going to say has immediate relevance to you. Now, I'm going to preface my remarks by just reading a little bit to get the flavor of it, of the introduction of this book. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. These students, as they became in Babylon, had experienced a seismic shock in their lives. Their culture had been dramatically changed in a very short space of time. They had grown up in a tiny state in Judah in a predominantly monotheistic culture. suddenly, when Nebuchadnezzar invaded their country, he was the emperor of a superpower and took them away. Within a few days, they were faced with a new language, a new culture, a new educational system, a new legal system, a polytheistic culture of the highest kind in the ancient world. And they had to cope with it. So what happened to Daniel was this. He was moved geographically and experienced change of culture. Many of us, especially if you're as old as I am, and by the way, don't get old. There's no point in it. But if you happen to get old like I am, I have not moved geographically. The culture has changed around me. So the idea of change of culture, when I think of my own upbringing, strongly monotheistic, strongly Christian, rarely meeting anybody else from another culture, and now the culture has completely changed around us. And so there we find a point of contact, an immediate point of contact with Daniel in the ancient world. And then his move was from a pretty simple culture to a very highly advanced high-tech culture. Babylon was an incredible city, the largest city in the ancient world, about of a quarter of a million people, and it had this very famous professional street going down from the Ishtar Gate, and on each side there were the ancient equivalent of skyscrapers. The architecture was stunning. And if you've been to the Pergamon Museum in East Berlin, or at least Berlin now, you'll have seen this reconstruction of the Ishtar Gate. It was a breathtaking place. And its cultural impact is profound. We can see it in this room. In fact, I suspect you can see it, each of you, on your wrist. Because if you're wearing a watch, you will have noticed, I hope by now, that there are 60 seconds in a minute, and there are 60 minutes in an hour. That division into 60 goes right back to the 6th century and beyond BC. Because the Babylonians discovered that 60 was a lovely number. It was divisible by many whole numbers. And they thought it would be a very good number to use as a base of their counting system. They were impressive mathematicians. One or two of their skyscrapers were used for astronomy stroke astrology. They made some very clever observations. Of course, they built all kinds of mysticism on top of them. They invented some medical operations that even in front of medics, I wouldn't like to describe to you. But there is a lot of literature on Babylonian surgery, for example, done in the absence of any anesthetic that was invented much later. But they were ingenious people. They were engineers, they had air conditioning. They had water coursing around their city, and so on and so forth. They were light years ahead of Judah. And so we need to imagine someone who's bright, a bright group of friends. It was traumatic. They had to leave their parents behind. They had to leave their culture behind. But now that they were forced into Babylonian culture, you can imagine it didn't take long before they were utterly fascinated at the opportunities that this swinging city offered. And many of you haven't been forced to leave your countries, and it's wonderful to have such an international group here. You come voluntarily and you've sought to take the opportunity of going to a university city away from your own home, and that will enrich your lives immeasurably. These young men were forced to do it. But it's quite clear in the end that they didn't inwardly tear themselves to pieces because, and this is the remarkable thing, they left Judah as believers in God. And Daniel, through all the trauma of his experience in the educational system in Babylon, and later in the administration of the two countries, not only didn't lose his faith in God, he didn't lose his witness. But as I mentioned last night, that is a very challenging thing. So easy to begin to allow your initial enthusiasm for the gospel to be eroded under pressure of what other people think. And fear and shame start to lessen your impact on the community around you. Daniel didn't allow that to happen. Why should we study the book? For this reason, if we can get any help at all, on how to remain stable, vertical, and witnessing in a polytheistic, multicultural society from this book, that is worth getting. And I believe that Daniel, in high old age, writes this book, and out of the events in his life, he chooses those that were fundamentally significant for his stand as a believer in God. And you might just remember that he didn't know, if you've been a Christian more than a few weeks, he didn't know a hundredth of what you know. And yet he stood. So it's worth getting into this to understand exactly what was happening. But one or two general remarks to introduce the book. It's a very interesting book because it is written in two languages, not simultaneously, but there's an Aramaic, there's a Hebrew bit, an Aramaic bit, and then a Hebrew bit. And the scholars have wondered how that happened. Well, not being a scholar, I can rush in where angels fear to tread. I make the simple observation that Aramaic was the lingua franca in that time in that part of the world. Secondly, I noticed that this book was not entirely written by Daniel on its own confession. Chapter 4 starts, I, Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar may have enlisted Daniel's help to write his testimony, but nevertheless, it is written in the first person and therefore is a remarkable ancient document because it is a testimony of how the most powerful man in the world found God. And it's written in a language that everybody could understand. So from one perspective, the book of Daniel is an evangelistic tract written by the emperor in part. And we need to bear that in mind because although it bears the name Daniel as the author, there are various foci, and one of them is the emperor's dawning realization that there is a God, that there is another world. And so we can see this witness being effective at the very highest level in the land. The second thing is, what are we going to make of this book? Its authenticity has been questioned for centuries. The reason for that is obvious. Because Daniel claims to be writing in the 6th century BC. But towards the end of his book, he gives us such an accurate description of the so-called Hellenistic period, that is down from Alexander the Great to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in about 160 BC. It's so accurate that many people say Daniel must have lived at the later time so that he knew the history that had gone past. The question they're raising is a fundamental one. Is there such a thing as real predictive prophecy? Or is this simply a 2nd century BC person calling himself Daniel and positioning himself in the 6th century to make an impressive attempt at prophecy? Now that question we shall come back to. But it is important at least to realize that Daniel as a book, gears into history. He starts with a historical note, and there are various cylinders and tablets written in this marvelous cuneiform script, wedge-shaped script. I'm amazed, you know, at the Babylonians, because they did mathematics using this script. And you imagine trying to work out the square root of 2 using those wedge shapes. It's absolutely spectacular. They managed to do it. But this is Nabonidus, one of the emperors of Babylon, commemorating his rebuilding of the ziggurat. More importantly for us, here is the Babylonian Chronicle on a tablet of stone, and it mentions the captured Jerusalem, which I've just read to you from the book of Daniel. So a direct historical corroboration. Now, of course, many of these archaeological things take a great deal of time. And for many years, people felt Daniel cannot be a genuine book with a strong historical dimension because it mentions a king called Belshazzar. Nobody'd ever heard of him until a stone tablet was turned up. And there was the name of Belshazzar. So end of that objection. And as time has gone on, there have been all kinds of historical corroborations of the authenticity at the historical level of Daniel in Babylon. So we've looked at that very briefly. The next thing is a question of worldview. This is hugely important in the 21st century. And I wish to argue that there's very little difference between the 21st century in Babylon, and the 6th century BC in Babylon, and the 21st century in Europe, and actually in the rest of the world. Judah, that Daniel had left, was a monotheistic culture. They believed in the God of the Bible. Whereas in Babylon, the religious air was full of all kinds of ancient creation myths, first of all. The famous ones are the Enuma Elish, the flood epic Atrahasis, and then later you had Philo's cosmogony. And when you look at these, you will find there's a common thread in those ancient accounts. First of all, they are very polytheistic. Secondly, most of them describe a power struggle for supremacy among the gods. Thirdly, their view of humans is fairly low. Humans were often made as an afterthought to lessen the work of the gods. Then creation proceeded through sexual union of the gods. But most importantly, theogony preceded cosmogony. Now, what does that mean? We understand cosmogony, the genesis of the cosmos. How did the cosmos begin? But they had something prior to that. Theogony, how did the gods begin? That's something we don't think about much, but we need to think about it. Because if you investigate the Babylonian philosophies, you will find that in the beginning, there is primeval matter, sometimes called Ur-Nammu, a primeval sea or soup. That's not a new idea at all. Mass energy, and everything, including the gods, develops out of that material. Now, try and get your head around what that means, because we tend to think, oh, they were idolatrous. Yes, they were. We're not idolatrous. Well, not in that sense. But when you look at what is behind the idol symbols, it's that these idols were products of the basic forces of the universe. They came from mass and energy. Fast forward to the 21st century. Paul Davis, brilliant physicist, and he says, of course there's superintelligence out there in the universe. It's superior to ours, but it's not supernatural. It has evolved from the basic stuff of the universe, just as much as our intelligence has. That is the Babylonian view. Let me put it another way. They were, strictly speaking, materialists. That is, mass energy were capable of developing everything. That is the dominant philosophy in the Western Academy today. Materialism. And here's another huge point of relevance for the book of Daniel. He shifted from monotheism to materialism, biblical monotheism to naturalism. And that's exactly where we are today. Those of us who are monotheists, who believe in God, who are biblical theists, are outnumbered, vastly outnumbered, by people who are materialists. Hence the relevance of this book, because Daniel was up against exactly the same interpretation of the universe as you are up against. They simply deified the forces of nature, and as I've just said, many contemporary thinkers do essentially the same. They regard the forces of nature as the ultimate controllers of nature. And of course, denying a creator God, they don't get rid of the idea of creation. They invest mass energy with creative powers. You will never get rid of the idea of creation. Everybody believes in some kind of creator. And it's either the transcendent God of the Bible who created the universe and maintains it, or, well, the popular thing these days is not mass energy, it's actually nothing. As you may be aware, and if you want to ask me about nothing in the question session this afternoon, I'd be delighted to give you a lecture about nothing. But it is nowadays, we are for the first time, I believe, in history, faced with the choice between God and nothing to account for the existence of our universe. So that is essentially contemporary secular naturalism. So we've seen that background. Now the next background to look at, or rather foreground, is to have a look at the book as a whole. We shall not have time to go through it in detail, but then I've written a book, you see. What I want to do, in a sense, is introduce some of the ideas in that book. But I want to give you a global bird's eye view, because I found in my life that learning to look at the Bible globally is infinitely more important than learning to look at it verse by verse. If you think about it, you would never study any other book just one verse after the next. You have to have some global picture of what it's about and where it's going. So I want to give you an idea of how to do that in a relatively short book, and that's Daniel. Now, the first thing you notice is that, well, about any book, is that the writer, if they have any intelligence at all, they write it in a certain order. It's not all over the place, because if it's all over the place, you don't bother reading it. And I'm a very kind author. I give my chapters titles, and people can see where it's going, and when they can go to bed, and when they should wake up, and so on. And there are basic kinds of order, the first of which is chronological. And many books are written in chronological order, and Daniel is partly. But then you discover that it's not completely chronological, because the revelations to Daniel described in chapter 7 and 8 occur before chapter 6. And then you notice there are different genre, literary genre in the book. There is, for instance, prophecy and narrative, but the book is not neatly divided into prophecy and narrative. So we have to look a little bit more deeply into its literary structure and thought flow. Now, my education is scientific, if you'll allow mathematics to be a science. But I wanted to be a classicist, and I've loved literature all my life. And learning to approach the books of Scripture as what they are, literature, has proved to be very important. So now we're going to go through the book of Daniel faster than you've ever gone through it before. Because what we're going to do is make a simple table of contents so that you recognize what's going on. Chapter 1, Daniel refuses the king's food in the University of Babylon. Chapter 2 describes an image that, a dream image that Nebuchadnezzar had of a colossal man that came crashing to the ground. Chapter 3 describes an actual golden image that Nebuchadnezzar set up, and he forced his leading people to bow down and worship it, otherwise they'd be thrown in a fiery furnace, and Daniel's three friends wouldn't bow and were thrown into it. Chapter 4 describes how Nebuchadnezzar saw a colossal tree, and the tree was cut down, and Nebuchadnezzar was told that he was the tree, and eventually he was cut down and had all kinds of psychological disturbances and began to behave like an animal for 7 years, until at the end his kingdom was restored. So the discipline and restoration of Nebuchadnezzar. Then Belshazzar, who knew all about what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, ignored it and held the famous Belshazzar's feast, where he took the vessels that were in the museum in Babylon that had been taken from God's temple in Jerusalem, and he forced his nobles to drink out of them and praise the gods of wood and stone. And at that moment, a hand came out and wrote on the wall of the palace, and in that night, Belshazzar was slain, and the empire of Babylon, that is the dynasty of Babylon, came to an end, and the Medo-Persians took over. Chapter 6 is the famous story of Daniel in the lion's den, put there because he refused to pray to the king. Chapter 7, Daniel has a vision of four beasts or four animals. Chapter 8, he has a complementary vision of two animals. And chapter 9, Daniel is reading the prophecy of Jeremiah and discovers to his excitement that Jeremiah has predicted that something big is about to happen in Jerusalem. And he prays to God, and God reveals to him that because of their rebellion and sin, history is going to be more complex than he thinks. And you get the very famous prophecy about Jerusalem, the 77s or 70 weeks. And then it's obvious that chapters 10, 11, and 12 form one lengthy section, the final one. And they claim to be an exposition of the writing of truth, discussing the time of the end. So that's the book of Daniel. And if you look at that carefully, you discover there's a literary structure running through it. First of all, you start with Babylonian administration. Then you have two images. One a dream image, one a real image. Then you have two kings disciplined. One is disciplined and restored. The other is disciplined and not restored. And then you have administration again, but this time in the Medo-Persian regime. And then you have two pairs, two visions of animals and two writings explained. And so you have a fairly obvious literary structure. The book splits into two, 1 to 5, 6 to the end, and follows a pattern within that. And if you set them side by side, you will see it looks something like that. So that the first half of the book goes to the end of Babylonian supremacy. The second half of the book goes to the time of the end, including the resurrection of the dead, and so on. So the idea of progress towards an end of some kind is very much in the heart of this book. Now let's look very briefly, because we look at some of the detail, just to get the overview of the first half. We've seen Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Jerusalem, Daniel's deportation and training, and he protests against the college food. Then Nebuchadnezzar, vision of empires in form of a colossal man. And then the colossal golden image that he insists his leaders bow down to. Then Nebuchadnezzar's discipline and restoration in forms of a colossal tree. And then finally Belshazzar's banquet, discipline and judgment, the end of Babylon. And you will notice the emphasis on size. There's a huge dream image in the form of a man. There is a second huge image, again in the form, probably, of a man-god. And then there is a colossal tree. All of them communicating the obvious message that Nebuchadnezzar was a very big man. Man written large in every sense of the word. So now we can begin to see and orientate ourselves. How does it start? And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. This is a historical remark, and it's a very strange one. Because, of course, Jehoiakim was a very weak king of a very tiny country. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of a superpower. And here's Daniel not simply saying, and Nebuchadnezzar invaded our country and captured Jerusalem. That would have been okay for most historians. But to dare to suggest that God had anything to do with it was ludicrous. You think about it. If it had read, and the Lord gave Nebuchadnezzar into the hand of Jehoiakim, that would have been very impressive. The little country conquering the big country. But surely any social scientist or any historian of any worth could tell you, this has got nothing to do with God. This has got to do with Darwinism among the nations, the survival of the fittest. Hasn't it? And now's the challenge number one. Is there a God behind history? Daniel dared to interpret the history and interpret in a way that looked extremely weak and not plausible. And yet he dared to do it. And I want to suggest to you that that's his first secret. His unshakable confidence that God was behind history. Now remember, he'd suffered from that history. This wasn't a wonderful experience he'd had, saying, isn't God marvelous, you know? No. He lost his family, he'd lost his home, he'd lost his culture. And yet he believed God was behind it. That's a very big step. And just as he believed God was behind global history, he believed God was behind his own personal history. Do you? Do you? It's so important, isn't it? To settle this in our mind, in spite of the appearances to the contrary. Is there a God who's interested in little me? Now, at the heart of our Christian faith, let alone biblical faith in the Old Testament, that is an assertion that is made that God is interested in us. But in this conference, I know, because I was once younger, there are people here asking big questions about God's involvement in their history, in their trajectory, in their career. And they've huge question marks. That's okay. It's okay to have questions. Keep asking them. But the crucial thing to do is to learn, and it can be very difficult, to overcome all those hurts where history may have damaged you and you feel resentful of it, to somehow rise above it and bring it to God. Daniel clearly did that. Because it's quite obvious in the way he behaved subsequently that there was no resentment in the end. He learned to trust the God of history. So that's point number one. And we'll see that coming out again and again and again. Now, point number two is the odd way in which the writer continues. He said, Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem. And instead of talking about himself, Daniel, and his friends being taken, he gives what seems at first sight a totally irrelevant detail in a compressed description of this kind. He says, Nebuchadnezzar comes to the temple and he takes some of the vessels from the temple of God in Jerusalem and he brings them to the temple of his God and he puts them in the treasury of his God. And sometimes when I'm reading that publicly, I leave that out and I ask people, did you notice what I left out? And they didn't notice a thing. Because the thing about the vessels seems utterly irrelevant. But it isn't. You see, being a scientist, I know that sometimes, and you find this in medical research as well, it's the little anomalies that turn out to be the most interesting things. And you pursue the anomaly and you say, just what's going on here? Why is that reading like that when I would have thought it would be like that? And you get a Nobel Prize for medicine as a result. Well, I hope some of you will. Those vessels, why mention them? Are they important? Massively important. If you're to ask the question, why did this empire fall? It was because of the vessels. Because you remember what happened to them. They reappear again. They appear in the first few sentences of the book, and they appear at the middle point of the book, where Belshazzar takes them out of the museum where Nebuchadnezzar puts them, places them on his table, fills them with wine, and uses them to get his nobles to drink from. And the writing comes and the empire collapses. Are they important? Yeah, very important. Excuse me. So now we have to ask, why the importance? So let's look very carefully at exactly what the text says. They're taken from the temple of God. They're put in the temple of Marduk or someone in Babylon, in the treasure house of his God. Now, Babylon was full of temples, hundreds of them. Some people calculate over 1,000 at the time of Daniel. And there were museums because these were people of high culture. They loved to fill their museum with with all kinds of artifacts that had been got by various means from around the world, like our museums today. Constant disputes. We own that. No, you don't. We took it, and so on. Well, let's just pass over that in silence. But in the museum, you put things that you value. And Nebuchadnezzar, many of these emperors were as naive as four-year-olds. Look what a big boy am I. And they'd have a text over the exhibition case with all these lovely vessels saying, I, Nebuchadnezzar, on the 4th of June, B.C., well, he wouldn't have written that, such and such, overcame this nation. Look at these artifacts. What a wonderful king I must be to beat up people who can do that. That's the kind of thing. He valued them. Otherwise, he wouldn't have put them there. Now think, what is he doing? Well, those vessels represented to Daniel and his friends absolute value. They believed in a God who was the determinator of value. And God said, "Let us make man in our image." Do ever reflect on the fact that the universe is not made in his image? It shows his glory, but it's not made in his image. You are. And human beings bearing the image of God are therefore of infinite value. That's a tremendously powerful message to get into the atheistic space, you know. The value system that is bequeathed to us by biblical monotheism. And in fact, that statement is the root of our values and has been in Western society for millennia. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let us make human beings in our image. And here's a huge question. From the ancient world, from this book, is there such a thing as absolute value? Aren't all values relative? Well, Nebuchadnezzar thought to a certain extent they were, because the whole point of the museum was that there was one absolute, and we see that in the subsequent chapters, that was Nebuchadnezzar himself. And everything else was relative. There was the artifacts from Judah, the artifacts from another country, and so on. So what he did can be formulated like this. He took something of absolute value and he made it of relative value. Do you recognize that? Because that's what's happening all the time today. And that's one of the major pressures that's on all of us, to rock our stability and to undermine our witness, is to lose that sense of the absoluteness of God and the uniqueness of Christ. And once that starts to erode, it takes everything else down with it. There is a battle in your heart and mind, and in my heart and mind, to stand for those things and not to relativize the absolute. You see, the subtlety of this is, it shows respect. Oh yes, we think Jesus is okay, you know. Wonderful, if you like Jesus. By myself, I prefer crystals, really. And magic mushrooms and something like that. And that's fine. There's no sense of uniqueness. And the two big issues that the ancient world didn't like about Christianity were, first of all, its supernaturalism, and we'll have plenty to say about that in Daniel, and secondly, its uniqueness claims about Christ. There is no other name whereby we must be saved. Do we really represent that? Haven't you felt in company when people say, well, you know, all religions lead to the same thing? Jesus is one teacher and there are other teachers and so on and so forth. Please don't, in this global village, insist that Jesus is the only way to God. Ever felt that? Of course you have. This is this. It's a question of values. And it's very interesting that making God an absolute value is something that lies at the heart of the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. Our Father, who are in heaven, hallowed be your name. Set apart be your name. This is our unique value. And I can imagine Daniel and his friends on times when they had a half day off from their lectures, coming down to the museum and looking at those vessels, gold, and saying, guys, that's what we stand for. Let's never lose it. Standing for those values. And then finally for this morning, Nebuchadnezzar's educational policy. He was a genius, this chap was, because what he did was he took the best of the students from the lands he'd conquered and he put them into King's College Babylon for a 3-year course, which is probably where Oxford and Cambridge got it from originally. And he was highly enlightened, because if you read the text carefully, you can see these people were going to be administrators. This was a master's, a fast-track master's in business administration. But in addition to law and all the kinds of subject they would normally be taught, you will notice that he taught them the culture and language of the Chaldeans. This was brilliant, you see. He absorbed them. And of course, Daniel and co, one of the secrets of their witness was they knew intimately the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And I wonder, do you know the literature and language of your cultures around you? We've got some work to do, haven't we? Paul loved people enough to read what they read, and so that he could meet them and form a bridge. We need to do the same. And as I was told many years ago, if you want people to find you interesting, you'd better be interested. Be interested in loads of things so that you can build bridges with people. Don't become a monomaniac. Do you know what a monomaniac is? Somebody who can only talk about God and who changes their voice every time they do and frightens people to death. Have you ever met people like that? It is remarkable. You meet people, they can talk about football, not calmly, usually really enthusiastically. They talk about politics. They even talk about President Trump. And when it comes to God, they suddenly become so earnest. And they frighten people to death. I hope, well, you've learned it by now, to talk about God in the same way as you talk about the fibia. Do you know what the fibia is? I hope so. In other words, to be natural, to be prepared to change the conversation if people sense that you're pressurizing them. We'll come to that later. My final point is this. This is what happened. These people had names. And you can imagine, at the mensa in the evening, the refectory, a Babylonian, let's call him Nabu, comes up to these four and says, oh, who are you guys? I haven't seen you before. The name is Daniel. Daniel? Dan-E-L. Yes, Dan-E-L. Haven't heard that name before. What is it? Does it sound Semitic? Yes, it is. Does it have a meaning? Yes, it does, actually. It's God is my judge. God is your what? Listen, my name's Nabu. I'm named after the moon god. God is your judge. Oh, are you one of those Hebrews that we beat up the other week? Ah, well, it's very understandable. I mean, if you believe in a god who's your judge, no wonder you get beaten up. What a grim view of life that represents. And you just watch the wheels turning. Nabu, are you studying on our course? Yes. I notice that we're studying the law of Hammurabi at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Yes, I'll be in the class as well. Oh, really? I'm hoping to be a judge. Oh, are you really? So you believe in justice. On what basis is justice held? What is the fundamental thing, concept, that upholds law? And then Daniel steps in, well, it's God is my judge, actually. Without that, you've no ultimate justice. And you can just see them going to it, you see. And the others with their names, Hananiah breaks in after a few minutes and said, Daniel, okay, we've got the judgment idea across, but let me tell him my name means God shows grace. And Nabu jumps in, oh, you're just like us. You believe in the judge God and you believe in the grace God. No, says Mishael. There's only one God. Who is what God is? And after they've had a terrific argument at the table, Azariah finally stops and he says, I need to tell you what my name means. My name means the Lord helps. You know, this is real, Nabu. We, even though we've been beaten up by your emperor and we're sitting here as captives, we believe it's real. Do you know, you could nearly preach the gospel from those four names, couldn't you? I have many times. But, you see, they weren't going to be allowed to do it. They were to be forced by a brilliant piece of social engineering to forgo the witness of their names, and they were going to be homogenized and made the same. So they were all given pagan names. What a powerful thing that is. You can't help what names people call you, but you can see what's going on. Make them all the same. Dress them all the same. Nobody must step out of line. Give them all a safe space. Don't say anything that might offend. Have you heard that before? It's coming in our university societies as never before. This is the root of it in the 6th century BC. The danger of having leaders that have distinctives that don't fit in with state policy. That's a huge issue. And there's more to it than meets the eye. But my eye has met with a clock. So if you want to hear any more, you'll have to come this afternoon. Thank you very much.